Welcome. Today is Tuesday, June 7th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, can diplomacy calm anxiety over disputes in the South China Sea? A documentary highlights Muhammad Ali's bond with his children and close friends. Tensions build in the ranks of Republicans over comments by Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton secures the delegates she needs as Bernie Sanders vows to fight on.
We've got to be unified going into the convention and coming out of the convention to take on Donald Trump.
Also ahead, Muslim Americans observing Ramadan. It's all on today's International Edition. And we begin with the U.S. presidential race. State primary contests conclude this week with the most populous state of California as the biggest prize, but lifted by a big win in Puerto Rico and a burst of late support from Democratic superdelegates, Hillary Clinton has now commitments from the number of delegates she needs to become the Democratic Party's presumptive nominee for president. And Tuesday's primaries are expected to hand her even more delegates, even as Bernie Sanders vows to continue.
I'm going to do everything I can to unify the Democratic Party, and I certainly am going to be reaching out to Senator Sanders and hope he will join me in that.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joins me. Catherine, we thought this day would never come, but Bernie Sanders still hoping somehow, if he wins California, that maybe potentially could change things as far as the superdelegates go. He said this past weekend that he plans to fight on into the convention, promising to make the case to the superdelegates that he's better positioned to beat Donald Trump in November. But since the start of the AP survey in late 2015, so far no superdelegates have switched from supporting Clinton to backing Sanders.
So here's where those fun superdelegates come in that Bernie Sanders likes to talk about. Now, superdelegates aren't bound by the way voters vote. They get to decide how they want to vote. And his argument is that that's not a fair reflection of the democratic process. And his hope is that possibly they could switch if he wins big in California.
What's interesting, though, is back in 2008, when Hillary Clinton was running against now President Barack Obama, before she actually conceded, Bernie Sanders said, well, Barack Obama has the right number of delegates, so he is the presumptive nominee, and he went ahead and endorsed him.
That's right. And it was exactly 8 years ago that Obama clinched and Clinton conceded, and that those words may come back to haunt Bernie Sanders.
As far as Hillary Clinton goes, obviously Donald Trump is prepared to throw everything at her that he can think of, including dredging up the past regarding indiscretions by her husband.
Right. The interesting thing here is that the way that the email scandal over the private server and her use of emails during her time as Secretary of State has allowed Trump to kind of revive some of these bigger questions about Clinton's trust and credibility, which then stretches back to her time during her husband's presidency.
And then Donald Trump, he's gotten some endorsements as of late from some top Republican leaders, but now they are taking issue with some of the things he is saying.
Paul Ryan had an interesting week where, after much hemming and hawing and hesitation, he finally decided to endorse Trump. He came out and said in an editorial that he would vote for Donald Trump. And then not even 24 hours later, he had to deal with this whole Mexican judge issue, where Donald Trump said some really unfortunate things about the ethnicity of a judge who is involved in the Trump University lawsuit. And then Ryan had to backtrack and say that these were unacceptable things. But of course, he'd already committed himself and said that he's voting for Donald Trump.
Well, it sounds like there are other GOP leaders also that are coming out really strongly against these statements, but Trump doesn't seem to be backing down.
Right. Very surprising move. Newt Gingrich, who a lot of people thought would be Donald Trump's vice presidential pick, said outright on one of the Sunday morning political talk shows that his statements about the Mexican judge were wrong, they were regrettable. And of course, Donald Trump lashed out on Twitter saying that, you know, this was an awful thing that Newt Gingrich did and he has betrayed him. And we actually might have hit a point where things are building against Donald Trump. He had a very combative press conference last week where reporters really pressed him about some of the Trump University questions, about the Mexican judge comments, and now Newt Gingrich coming out and then Paul Ryan backtracking. He might have actually overstepped his bounds this time around.
But he doesn't seem to be backing down. In fact, the latest I heard was he was encouraging his supporters to get behind what he's been saying about the judge.
That's right, because his supporters love the way that he speaks his mind and doesn't apologize for what he says. So really, he can only lose by backing down. He has to double down on his hand.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Catherine. Meanwhile, we are hearing that President Obama is on the verge of formally endorsing his former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and starting to aggressively make the case against Donald Trump. An announcement could come within days. White House and Clinton campaign aides have been discussing the sequencing of the long-expected announcement, and the president's schedule has several possible opportunities for maximizing impact. Now let's turn to what is happening on social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me with what people are talking about. Hi, G. What is the trending hashtag at this hour?
Hi, Lori. It's hashtag State of Women. That's also the name of the organization aimed at promoting gender equality. And what really helped with the popularity Monday is a little shout out from First Lady Michelle Obama. She's on Twitter at FLOTUS, as you know, and she not only appeared in its two-minute-long intro video, but the White House will also be hosting a summit on the issue on the 14th. She sent out this tweet. Together, we're stronger. Together, we can change tomorrow. Stand with us. And use the hashtag State of Women. The video tagged to that tweet pokes fun at gender inequality in America. And surprisingly, for a public announcement type of video, it's quite interesting. Have you seen it?
I haven't. And G, you said there will be a White House event. So what's the buzz from the source?
The White House also shared the same video starring Michelle Obama, and so did the Facebook account of the United States of Women. It already has nearly 8,000 likes and captioned the video like this. Today will change tomorrow. Because we are the United States of Women, watch the film and join Michelle Obama, Meryl Streep, Tina Fey, Oprah Winfrey, and all the other incredible women in the hashtag State of Women. So you know just from the cast that it's going to be amazing. Lori, I have to say I was quite impressed by the cast because it was very diverse. They not only had the First Lady and well-known female actors, but also a Muslim woman wearing a hijab, a Spanish-speaking woman, and another one using a sign language. Last but not least, there was also a transgender woman in that video. But from the comment section, one of the most liked replies was criticizing the very same diversity that some people enjoyed. A user named Katrina wrote, she finds it absolutely hysterical that a Muslim woman in this video was wearing a hijab, which she thought was a symbol of oppression. She also added a transgender woman does not understand the quote-unquote struggle of being a woman. Back to you, Lori.
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the other stories we are following at voanews.com. Indications North Korea has reopened a plutonium plant. The fastest growing language in the U.S., Arabic. Praise pours in for NPR journalists slain in a Taliban rocket attack. Muhammad Ali's funeral will be attended by Bill Clinton and other world leaders. China takes a cautious step toward opening up to U.S. investors. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The United States and China are used the opening of high-level talks in Beijing Monday to try and ease growing tensions over disputes in the South China Sea. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says more diplomacy is needed.
We are looking for a peaceful resolution to the disputes of the South China Sea. We are not a claimant. We have taken no position on any of the claims of any claimant. The only position we've taken is, let's not resolve this by unilateral action. Let's resolve this through rule of law.
But VOA State Department correspondent Nike Chang tells us the experts don't think diplomatic language is likely to stop China's activities in the disputed waters.
As we know, anxieties are growing in the region over China's aggressive approach to its territorial claims in the South China Sea, including construction and militarization. There is a new development. That is, there are talks that China is planning to establish an air defense identification zone, the so-called ADIZ, over the South China Sea. In response, Kerry said yesterday in Mongolia that such action would be provocative and destabilizing.
Well, China has long accused Washington of taking sides. Muslims around the world are marking the start of the holy month of Ramadan, including millions of American Muslims. I talked about the meaning of the holiday with Dawood Waleed, executive director of the Michigan chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations.
Ramadan is the ninth month on the lunar calendar and is the most holy time in the year for Muslims. It represents many things, the primary one of becoming more conscious of God's duties and what he expects us to fulfill as human beings. Ramadan is about fasting, but it's also about being charitable and commiserating with those who are less off in our society.
So, and this begins Monday?
Yes, the holy month of Ramadan, fasting begins on Monday.
And it lasts the entire month?
The month of Ramadan, which is a lunar month, it can last either 29 or 30 days, depending on the sighting of the crescent moon.
Tell me a little bit about what Muslims in America and around the world will be doing besides fasting and just how you would you describe what you do to practice the, I don't know how I'm trying to say this.
Let me think about it. The month of Ramadan to Muslims is the equivalent to Easter Sunday for Christians, but basically for our entire month, meaning that many Muslims who don't normally attend mosques will then attend mosques during the month of Ramadan at the nights for lectures or extra prayers. It is also a time of family, where family members make more of a point of having dinner together and breaking the fast together, whereas many Americans and Muslims worldwide are about the hustle and bustle of, going to work and being involved in other activities. But during the month of Ramadan, people are more intentional about having dinner and breaking the fast with their family. So Ramadan is a time for prayer. It's a time for socialization in the mosque, but it's also a time of reconnecting family bonds.
And the fasting, the significance of that?
Fasting during the month of Ramadan is about cultivating patience. So eating and drinking is something that is normally permissible in the other 11 months out of the year. During the month of Ramadan, from dawn to dusk, we're not supposed to eat or drink. And the philosophy around this is, if we are able to restrain ourselves from that which is lawful throughout the year, then outside of Ramadan, we'll be able to control ourselves relating those things that are unlawful for us throughout the year, be it gossiping and backbiting, telling lies, being the deceptive, or any other type of actions that are considered sinful according to the Islamic religion.
And finally, if you had to sum up the Muslim faith to outsiders who may not understand basically the premise of really what the heart of the religion is, that may or may not be so different from any other religion. You know, in like one sentence, what would you say?
Prophet Muhammad said, none of you truly believes until he loves for his brother or sister what he loves for himself. And after love for God, one of the most important teachings of Islam is that we are to love for our brothers and sisters and humankind what we love for ourselves. And if we can't rise to have empathy for fellow human beings, we're not being a true Muslim.
Fantastic. All right, you are listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Do you love music from Africa and the world? VOA has the latest hits, interviews with the artists, and we are glad to take your requests. The Voice of America has what you're looking for. We have music shows to please everyone. Join us on the radio or on the internet to listen day or night. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on your favorite program. Just follow your ears. Music from Africa and the world. We've got it on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, newly discovered audio tapes as heard in a documentary about the late Muhammad Ali. But first, nearly 8 years to the day after she conceded her first White House campaign to Barack Obama and famously noted her inability to, quote, shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling, an Associated Press count finds that Hillary Clinton has now secured the number of delegates needed to become the first woman to top the presidential ticket of a major U.S. political party. I spoke to Jennifer Lawless, director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University, about why more women in the U.S. don't hold public office and what the implications would be to finally elect the first female president.
In terms of numbers, they're significantly underrepresented. In the United States Congress, 81% of the members are men. 44 of the 50 states have male governors. 90 of the 100 largest cities have male mayors. And 75% of state legislators across the country are men. In fact, right now, about 95 nations outrank the United States in terms of the percentage of women in the national legislature. But when women run for office, they're just as likely as men to get reelected. They're just as likely as men to win their first election, and they raise just as much money.
Is it because women aren't interested in running for public office?
There are two factors that inhibit major progress. The first is the incumbency advantage. In an average election cycle, more than 90% of incumbents seek reelection, and then about 95% of them win reelection. So when you've got 80% of the U.S. Congress being men, that doesn't leave a lot of opportunities for previously excluded groups to make significant gains. The second is what Richard Fox and I have determined is a gender gap in political ambition. We've conducted surveys over the course of the last 15 years of women and men who are in the professions that are most likely to lead to political careers. And we find that for a series of reasons, women are about a third less likely than men even to consider running for office.
Why are women reluctant to seek political office?
Again, two reasons. The first is they're less likely to receive the suggestion to run for office from anyone. When women receive the suggestion to run and they are recruited and they get that encouragement, they're just as likely as men to respond favorably to it. And the second reason is that women and men who on paper look exactly the same don't self-assess the same way. About 60% of the men that we surveyed and interviewed thought that they were qualified to run for office, but only about 40% of women did. And women who don't think that they're qualified to run don't even think about running. Men who acknowledge that they're not qualified to run still have a pretty good chance of giving it serious thought. So this gender gap in perceptions of qualifications coupled with the gender gap in political recruitment.
We have a woman running for the White House right now, the likely Democratic nominee, and you've got some pro-Hillary Clinton PACs taking aim at the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, Donald Trump, for some of his previous comments regarding women. So what implications does the rise of Donald Trump and his approach have on women candidates or potentially Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think that what Donald Trump does is reinforce the worst aspects of politics and the general sense that there is rampant sexism. Danny Hayes, who's a professor at George Washington University, and I just last week published a new book called Women on the Run. And what we do is we look at congressional races and whether women and men receive similar media coverage, whether voters assess them the same way, whether they run similar campaigns. And we find very, very few differences between women and men. Yet, there are widespread perceptions that the political environment is far more treacherous for women than men. And it's because of very high-profile races and people like Donald Trump who are engaged in overt sexist commentaries.
And for Donald Trump, it doesn't seem like any of his comments so far have hurt him one bit.
Right. It doesn't seem like he's taken a hit. Of course, as we move toward the general election, his unfavorables among women are at about 70%. And that makes it very, very difficult to win because there's a gender gap in presidential politics where Democratic candidates generally receive a greater share of the women's vote than Republican candidates do. Donald Trump is starting with a major deficit, and it's unclear that he's going to do anything to get the level of support that he needs. But I would argue that an even bigger ramification of what he's doing and saying is that it's reinforcing this misperception that there's rampant bias against women when they throw their hats into the ring.
So what, if anything, might be different if Hillary Clinton, or any woman for that matter, becomes president of the United States?
Well, symbolically, I think it's very important because it would demonstrate that we finally achieved shattering, as Hillary Clinton would call it, that hardest, highest glass ceiling. And something looks strange when the United States, for example, encourages other nations to adopt gender quotas, when we praise other countries for having female heads of state, and we've never done those things ourselves. So I think that it lends a sense of legitimacy to our democracy. Beyond that, I think it also serves as this broader role model effect where young women and girls across the country are going to grow up seeing that a woman can run for president. And if a woman can run for president and that's just something that they're accustomed to, they might be more inclined to not doubt their own qualifications and not think that they don't look the part.
All right. Thanks so much, Jennifer Lawless, director of the Women in Politics Institute at American University. Well, with Muhammad Ali's passing, the world is remembering a man who transcended sports, culture, and religion to become a global icon. I Am Ali, a 2014 documentary by Claire Lewis, used audio tapes he recorded with family and friends to paint an intimate portrait of the boxing legend. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
My father has a lot of sides. And you hear about the fights. You don't hear about family that much and what that meant to him.
What's your dad's name?
Muhammad Ali.
No one, not even some members of his family, knew of the existence of these audio tapes until recently.
Ma'am? You're now 11 years old.
They thread the narrative of the boxing champion's life in Claire Lewis's documentary. Ali's daughter, Hannah, offered the tapes to Lewis.
Say, I love my daddy.
I love my daddy.
I love my poo-poo-head daddy.
Okay. My father was always conscious about history. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why he made this series of audio tape cassette recordings.
Say, float like a butterfly, sing like a bee.
The film shows the whole world in love with him. Testimonials of friends and adversaries paint the Olympian and three-time boxing champion Cassius Clay, later Muslim convert Muhammad Ali, as a sensitive, poignant, and courageous man. Because he refused to serve in the Vietnam War, he was stripped of his championship title, and his boxing license was revoked. His close friend, former football player Jim Brown, remembers.
He had a lot of courage. The risk he had to take, and then to be isolated, to have his crown taken away, not be able to make a living, that was difficult.
But he stuck to his convictions, and in 1974, at the age of 32, Ali made a comeback.
When George Foreman meets me, he'll pay his debt. I can drown a drink of water and kill a dead tree. Wait till you see Muhammad Ali.
He defeated formidable George Foreman and recaptured his title.
I get into the ring with the guy. I bluffed him. I done everything. Beat him up. Basically for about 5 or 6 rounds. I thought it was easy. Then about the 6th round, he whispered in my ear after I'd hit him in the side, "That all you got, George?" And that was about all I had.
I Am Ali does not say much about his broken marriages, but it highlights his bond with his children.
I was the Concorde of boxing. I was at a high altitude than the rest, moving fast.
As Ali has aged, we hear him begin to slur his words, a sign of developing Parkinson's disease. He finally retired in the late 1970s, and in the mid-80s, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. But to the world and his children, he remains an icon of power and grace.
If anyone wonder why me, Muhammad Ali, is making these tapes, is because history is so beautiful.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's going to do it for this edition of the program. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. You can find us anytime at voanews.com or follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. You can also follow me at Lori London. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zeynep Abdurrahman. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a fantastic day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On May 30th, a special court in Senegal delivered a guilty verdict against former Chadian president Hissène Habré. He was found to be responsible for numerous war crimes and crimes against humanity, including torture, rape, sexual slavery, and the murder of as many as 40,000 people, and sentenced to spend the rest of his life in prison. Hissène Habré became president of Chad in 1982 when his anti-government rebel group seized N'Djamena, the country's capital, overthrew the elected government and appointed Habré as head of state. For the next 8 years, Habré and his cohort, including the much-feared secret police, conducted large-scale human rights abuses, including detention, torture, and murder. The regime particularly hounded members of ethnic groups that Habré saw as political rivals, frequently arresting their leaders en masse, and from time to time engaged in ethnic cleansing tactics against them. 8 years after he came to power, Hissène Habré was deposed and fled to Senegal. It took 25 years of hard work on the part of human rights groups and his victims to bring him to trial in a process that could signal a turning point for international justice in Africa. The trial, conducted by the specially created Extraordinary African Chambers, marked the first time an African Union-backed court convicted a former ruler for human rights abuses, and the first time that the courts of one country have prosecuted the former ruler of another country for crimes against humanity. This ruling is a landmark in the global fight against impunity for atrocities, including war crimes and crimes against humanity, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. The United States strongly commends the Senegalese government, the Chadian government, and the African Union for creating the Extraordinary African Chambers that allowed for a fair and balanced trial. And we especially salute the nearly 100 victims of the accused who testified against him. In the words of Secretary of State Kerry, let this be a message to other perpetrators of mass atrocities, even those at the highest levels and including former heads of state, that such actions will not be tolerated and they will be brought to justice.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is for...